Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Hassan here with you for the next half hour. We'll have five stories for you this week, and most of them from out west. We won't be talking about forest fires, but about the Drug Overdose Awareness Day and what community members are doing to try to combat the overdose epidemic in BC. We'll talk with the next drug dealer about how he overcame his own addiction, and with a woman who thought she was saving her brother's life.
I don't know how, but I threw stuff out of my way. I had to throw a tent out of my way, a big heavy bicycle, and the next thing I knew, I was on top of him and doing CPR. Now he's my brother. And he's doing great, and I'm so proud of him.
And then to Alberta, where four universities will share a new fund for technology innovation. And also related to education, the difficult issue of housing is making life difficult for students from one end of the country to another. The BC Selkirk College is asking the community to open up its doors to students. And then continuing with our back-to-school theme, we'll go to Nova Scotia, where students are also trying to contend with higher tuition fees.
We know now that we're in Nova Scotia about 36.5% above the national average for domestic tuition for students that are from Canada, and then it's increasing at a disproportional rate.
This and more on Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks so much for keeping us company. First up, we go to British Columbia, where Selkirk College reached out to the community this week, hoping to find additional housing for students. Between Castlegar and Nelson campuses, there are approximately 2,000 students enrolled for in-person programs. But in recent weeks, students have been dropping their courses for the fall semester because they are unable to find affordable places to live. The college says it's unknown how many students have dropped their programs because of the lack of housing and how many need housing, but it is a concern. Here are some good news. Since reaching out to the community earlier this week, the college says they have received several emails from members of the community willing to open their homes to students. Here's Scott Anishuk.
Selkirk College students are scrambling to find affordable housing in Nelson and Castlegar ahead of the fall semester. The school does already have a homestay program, and the Castlegar campus and 10th Street campus in Nelson provide on-site housing, but it's not nearly enough. The Castlegar and Silverkin campuses are both undergoing construction to add a total of 150 additional units, but those won't be ready until 2024. In a recent press release, Selkirk College is asking the community to open their homes and rent to students. Allison Alder, a dean at Selkirk College, says renting to college students brings many benefits that go beyond the monthly boost to the bank account.
Students are great. They're lively. They're in the process of moving their lives forward, and they're typically engaged and hardworking, and they are good in our homes. They're good in our communities. Hopefully people will be interested in getting to know some students better and providing some housing.
Several students have already dropped their programs because of the lack of housing. However, Selkirk College says there have been community members already reaching out to offer housing since the press release earlier this week.
That was Scott Anishuk reporting from Kootenay, BC.
Okay, man, let's go. Okay.
And at the other end of the country, a recent report published by Students Nova Scotia notes that tuition fees in the province are the highest in the country. Students Nova Scotia is an organization which advocates for students in the province, and tuition fees keep on rising. The cost of tuition in Nova Scotia has increased by 20% in the last 6 years. Domestic university tuition is 36.5% over the national average, Students Nova Scotia says. The average undergraduate tuition fees are close to $9,000 in Nova Scotia, while the national average sits at $6,834. The organization is asking the government to cap tuition at a 1% increase. Journalist Haley DiRizio spoke to Georgia Selesky, executive director from Students Nova Scotia in Halifax.
It's a popular destination for students. Right now, enrollment is remaining kind of high at the place where it has been for the past few years. We're still seeing students, particularly international students, coming from all over in order to study in this province. I think we're at great risk to see that change and to go the other way. I think that right now is there's a big turning point in kind of the post-secondary world that we live in because of housing, because of healthcare, because of the state of things post-COVID. We're finally getting back into what I'm going to say is the most normal that we've had since. And that being said, certain things I think are coming to light. And while this is not a new problem, I think there's a lot more attention on it and it's getting worse. I think that the problem right now is that we're not just seeing post-secondary educations being in jeopardy, we're seeing students being in jeopardy. And that is going to have a huge impact on the political and economical climate in Nova Scotia. We know that here our universities in the province are the second driving force of export revenues. And that being said, we need to be able to maintain those for growth and development. We need researchers. We need medical care providers. We need construction workers. These are all things that students provide and that universities provide. And I think being able to look at students as the, you know, the foundation of our institutions and to be able to uplift them and provide them with increased access and reduced barriers to their education is really the goal.
Haley DiRizio's full interview with Georgia Selesky can be found at canada-info.ca.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosna in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
And as a new school year also gets underway in Alberta, the province announced that it is investing $23 million into university tech and innovation research projects. With this investment, the Alberta government hopes to become a bigger player in the technology sector in the future. Four Albertan universities will share the $27.3 million investment over the next 4 years through the Major Innovation Fund. This to help bolster the chosen university's space and defense technologies, clean energy and health technologies. More on this with Ryan Hunt in Edmonton, Alberta.
The Alberta government announced on September 5th, as classes started up around the province, that Alberta's top universities, that being the University of Alberta, University of Calgary, University of Lethbridge and Athabasca University, are receiving a shared investment of $27.3 million over the next 4 years to help Alberta become a bigger player in the technology and innovation sector. Nate Glubish, the Minister of Technology and Innovation, spoke in a press conference and shared his excitement about the investment.
Post-secondary institutions like the U of A, like the U of C, like the U of L, like Athabasca University and so many more in Alberta, they have a great history and a track record of driving really exciting research. And then that research goes on to become a company. It goes on to become a product. It goes on to create jobs. It goes on to attract investment. That research is the lifeblood of technology in Alberta.
Glubish says that this investment will help Alberta make strides to become a bigger player in the tech sector than they already are.
We have seen Alberta leading the country in terms of venture capital investment growth. At a time when investment in other provinces is on a downward trajectory, we continue to see growth. It is great news telling us that Alberta's tech sector is booming. It is growing. The momentum is more exciting than we've ever seen it before. And I'm confident that investments like today's $27.3 million announcement will continue to drive that forward.
Dr. Ed McCauley, the President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Calgary, also spoke at the September 5th conference and shared his thoughts in what this investment will do, not only for the University of Calgary, but for Alberta as a whole.
This is a great day for innovation in Alberta. Our Alberta research universities will expand our central roles in growing Alberta as a technology and an innovation hub, attracting top talent and scholars from around the world, creating new businesses with the technology and the people that we produce, and stimulating job-creating investment. Look at what we've done already in the areas of quantum science and technologies, for example. I can't wait to see what we're going to do next. And with today's support, we're going to do more to help our economy grow and diversify.
Court Ellingson, an opposition critic for technology and innovation, made a statement in response to the government's September 5th announcement, saying that, quote, Nate Glubish and the UCP have cut $1 billion to our post-secondary institutions and have also driven up tuition costs by up to 40%. Today's announcement is a drop in the bucket compared to the investment that's needed to attract and retain talent while supporting innovation and economic growth through our post-secondary schools, unquote. I'm Ryan Hunt.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
And we now change gears to go back to British Columbia, as many communities marked on August 31st the International Overdose Awareness Day. We'll have two stories related to that topic, one from Terrace, BC, but first to Nanaimo, where a crowd of harm reduction advocates, people who use drugs, and local politicians gathered in Nanaimo's Maffeo Sutton Park to mark the International Overdose Awareness Day. People like Amy Chalifou saved the life of André Laflamme while doing outreach 5 years ago, originally thinking that the man was her son. Journalist Mick Sweetman met with some of the people present that day and prepared this for us.
According to the latest report by the BC Coroner Service, Nanaimo has seen 76 unregulated drug deaths in the first 7 months of 2023, just one shy of the annual all-time record of 77 deaths in 2022. Nanaimo has 5% of all drug deaths in the province this year, only behind the large cities of Vancouver, Surrey, and Greater Victoria. Central Vancouver Island has seen a total of 129 fatalities in the first 7 months, while South Vancouver Island has 95 and North Island has seen 51 deaths. Sarah Lovegrove is a registered nurse and the chair of the Nanaimo Community Action Team. She helped organize the Nanaimo event for International Overdose Awareness Day in Nanaimo's Maffeo Sutton Park.
This day is extremely emotional for me. I feel very sad listening to these stories, mainly because I know how deeply our community is impacted by this crisis, but also in recognition of the inaction of policymakers for the past several years and the fact that we have to continue having this day over and over again every single year, and the fact that it becomes more and more urgent each year. I also just feel deeply for my community and the ways that people have suffered and continue to suffer.
One of the people sharing stories at the event was Amy Chalifou, who works at the 710 Club, providing meals to the homeless. She told a story about finding a man overdosing in an encampment.
And I thought he was my son at first, because there was so much stuff in the way, and he was dead. And people around were screaming and crying and panicking. I don't know how, but I threw stuff out of my way. I had to throw a tent out of my way, a big heavy bicycle, and the next thing I knew, I was on top of him and doing CPR. Now he's my brother. And he's doing great. And I'm so proud of him.
Chalifou and André Laflamme stayed in touch, working together on a Cree language program, and attended the overdose awareness event together. Kisa Pavita is the peer outreach coordinator for the Nanaimo Community Action Team, who was able to access BC's prescribed safe supply program.
I was lucky to have the option to transition through my drug use from sobriety safely with very understanding doctors and friends who helped me access a non-toxic drug supply. Every time I wake up next to my wife, it feels like a gift because I have so many loved ones who were never given that chance. I still have so many friends who don't have the option to access safe supply. I am 23 years old, and I am sick of losing the people that I love. If I'm worthy of dignity and respect when I am using drugs because you don't know it, then I was worthy the whole time. And that means everyone else is also worthy of that same dignity and respect. It means my friends were and are.
Wanda LeBlanc was at the event with Mom Stop the Harm. Her son uses drugs, and she talked about the importance of safe supply.
I strongly believe in safe supply. If you would have talked to me 5 years ago, I would not be saying that. As a parent and the people that I know in Mom Stop the Harm, my opinions change completely. Safe supply is a way to engage people. It's a way to keep them alive long enough for them to find support, and it's a way to engage them and let them know that there is support out there for them. So that's what safe supply is about. It's not about providing drugs.
Lovegrove says that while the safe supply program is important, its efficacy is limited, both by the number of prescribers as well as the types of drugs that are available through it.
So Safe Supply, while it's a fairly accessible program, we're limited by the number of prescribers who are able to offer. So only a certain amount of people in Nanaimo specifically are able to access it because of the limitations around the people who prescribe. As well as the program in general from the provincial government is limited in its use of Dilaudid as a safe supply. We need to be meeting people where they're at in their substance use. So offering a safe supply of cocaine, of methamphetamines and other opioids and stronger opioids like fentanyl for people to be able to access, because right now what they're utilizing is not enough to meet the needs of their pain and trauma.
Social Development and Poverty Reduction Minister Sheila Malcolmson also spoke at the event, giving credit to local advocates and harm reduction workers.
There's so much grief in the community and in Nanaimo for such a long time. This community was hit harder and earlier than other communities in British Columbia, and British Columbia more than other parts of the country. It's been the grassroots and the practitioners here who have informed so much of what we have been able to build together, that the first community action team was in Nanaimo, and that then was the model for a grassroots-based response to the toxic drug crisis across all of British Columbia. It's because people here found their own way of working together with doctors, with outreach workers, with people who are elected. And so we are all here, all three levels of government here, with our open ears. The stories that you honor us with by sharing those who have been lost, it informs the work that we do every day. And it hasn't been enough.
While Lovegrove appreciated that Malcolmson, as well as local member of parliament Lisa Marie Barron and a handful of city councillors attended the event, she says that politicians are ultimately responsible for the failed response to the toxic drug crisis.
I often hear politicians speaking at these events, skirting the line of where their politics begin and end without really recognizing the need for immediate action and their level of responsibility within this crisis. So this is the overdose deaths are a policy failure, and it is the policymakers who need to implement change immediately. To do so, we can't do that as community members, as healthcare providers. We can't change policy. It's the one arm of this crisis that we cannot move, and it's up to policymakers to make those changes happen immediately.
LeBlanc was also critical of the government's actions.
I do not feel the government is responding. I think the response is so minimal. There is very little treatment. You know, when somebody with toxic drugs wants to get help, wants to be safe, there isn't places for them to go. You know, we talk about recovery and detoxing and treatment. It's, you know, when somebody wants to go into recovery, they want to do it when they're ready. Not 3 months from now, not 6 months from now. So the availability is really, it's not there. The government has not put enough money.
Sopovita says that further political action is needed to stem the tsunami of toxic drug deaths.
To our politicians with us today, you have the ability to create something that I can't create for myself, and that is hope. You have the ability to change my future and to change how I will spend the rest of my life. I'd love to spend it gardening, but this is where I have to spend it.
Lovegrove says that while there was frustration with the government at the event, ultimately it was more about creating the space where people could connect with one another.
I think what we really want to send home to people is the importance of compassion and the importance of doing this work from our hearts. We're not going to create any change without that level of compassion for humans and human rights. So if we try to dive deep into our hearts around this issue and let that guide us, then I think we can come together and find solutions.
This is Mick Sweetman.
I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.
Another event was organized at the George Little Park in Terrace, BC for Overdose Awareness Day. Journalist Sabrina Spencer took that opportunity to talk with ex-drug dealer William Morrison. He shared his personal story with Sabrina about overcoming addiction and how that has led him, along with his family, to become outreach workers for the Nishka Valley Health.
My name is William Morrison. I am outreach worker for Nishka Valley Health Authority. I come from a very checkered past. I was one of the drug dealers who was causing a lot of the harm out here in these streets. And, you know, I really didn't care about anyone except for myself until about 5 years ago when I began a journey to finding myself, to healing. And along that journey, I came to realize that I needed to give back, that we needed to give back. And, you know, a lot of these people out here, a lot of the people within my community who are suffering right now, you know, I basically handed them a lot of the bullets for that gun. And so right now, you know, my mission in life is to help them find a reason again. And, you know, and if that means being out there at midnight and just letting them know that they are loved, then that's what it takes, right? You know, like for me, it isn't about, you know, getting the world sober. For me, it's about the safety and the respect of our loved ones, because it's really, at this point, it's a human rights issue. It's so much more than the drugs. It's the fact that our government just doesn't seem to give a about our people who are dying every day, you know, and like it was just like I said, you know, when prohibition came around, the government took those steps to safeguard the people. And they, you know, they began creating this safe supply for people to use. And so where are the drug users' rights? You know, where are the people's rights who choose to use substance? And for me, it's about, you know, showing people that compassion, showing them that love that unfortunately they don't have for themselves, because, you know, as Indigenous people, we really, you know, grow up to not like who we are. And this is something that society puts on us. It's not even our parents' fault. This is things that we carry from residential school, is this hate in our heart for ourselves. And, you know, for me, an elder told me a while back when I was beginning my journey, that when I told him that I didn't give a what happened to me. And then he said, well, that's okay. I understand that. But you know what? I just need you to do, young man, is I need you to let us love you until you can find that love for yourself. Can you allow us to do that just for a couple of weeks? And if you still decide you don't want to be here, then we'll get you home. And so I said, sure. And this was when I was 14. And those words still ring in my head every time I see somebody who I care about, you know, living this life is, you know, we need to show them that love that they need to find for themselves. So, you know, it's about loving people until they can find the love that they need for themselves, because that's what saved me. You know, just like I said at that thing, the opposite of addiction is love and connection.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at canada-info.ca.
Thanks to Sabrina Spencer. Well, you know that Dozens of stories, well, I should say about 100, are produced each week by our English, Spanish, and French-speaking journalists posted all across the country. Too many of them do not make it to the show due to a lack of available airtime. Stories such as the one produced by MP Holmes in Kitchener, Ontario, for example, about how World Literacy Day put the spotlight on the low levels of literacy in the Waterloo region. She spoke to Jane Turr of Project Read Literacy Network. Turr explains what this looks like, the misconceptions about the people who fall below the literacy line, the Ontario government's return to phonics and language curriculum, and the gaps in the system.
It doesn't mean that people aren't intelligent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they actually don't even finish off university at times. People can be very smart and strategic themselves. Mm-hmm. I had one learner that really, he was what I would call the very, very low literacy levels. And yet he worked at a very decent job and was making decent money, but he could fake his way through things because he was a good, solid worker. He was head of janitorial services at a place, and he could do all of these different things. He would sweat. His boss would come in and say, "What do you think of this memo?" And he'd be hoping, I'm hoping I'm holding it the right way and shaking. And he would just turn and go, "Well, what do you think?" And he goes, yeah, we got to get it done. And then he would take it home to his wife to read, right? Like, he was just that quick at being able to go, what would be a good way to say this so that nobody knows, except the day that he was, all of a sudden all of his workers were gone and they were having a government inspection, and he was asked to clean, and so he went down and smelled a couple of bottles and went, "Oh, those are strong. Let's mix them together and wipe up the place." And it was bleach and ammonia. So they had to evacuate the building. Many people like immediately say, "Well, I know how to read." Very few people don't know how to read something or write something. It's about the ability to read it well enough to get things done. And I always go back to the thoughts of, can you imagine a parent that struggles with literacy reading the correct dosage on a child's aspirin bottle? They're not reading it correctly. Like, this is a bigger issue than just, you know, "Oh, well, they can't read and write. We got to get them into school." Nope, the majority of people were born and raised here. And it's usually, there's a lot of reasonings why this happens. Usually you'll find most of the time parents struggled with literacy issues themselves. They, you know, parents didn't know how to build literacy skills in their children when they didn't have literacy skills. If the kids miss any skills because of, childhood illnesses that we all get, they could be missing some important pieces of what they're supposed to be learning as their foundation. And that can happen. There's undiagnosed learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, moving between schools. So there's a lot of things that can cause this.
Listen to the complete story on canada-info.ca. So this concludes this edition of Viewpoints, thanks to our team of journalists hired through the Local Journalism Initiative. Haley DiRizio, Ryan Hunt, Mick Sweetman, Scott Onishak, and Sabrina Spencer. To our national editors, Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, with the indispensable contribution of your local radio station. And a warm welcome to a new addition to our team, Franchella Fialos, our new program officer. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Please stay tuned to the show that follows. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.
LJI.
Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.